leading to some ultimate success. First, nursery school or kindergarten, then the grades or forms of elementary school, preparing you for the great moment of secondary school. But then more steps up and up to the coveted goal of the university. Here, if you are clever, you can stay on indefinitely by getting into graduate school and becoming a permanent student. Otherwise, you are headed step by step for the great outside world of family raising, business and profession. Yet graduation day is a very temporary fulfillment, for with your first sales promotion meeting, you are back in the same old system, being urged to make that quota, and if you do, they'll give you a higher quota, and so progress up the ladder to sales manager, vice president, and at last, president of your own show, about 40 to 45 years old. In the meantime, the insurance and investment people have been interesting you in plans for retirement. That really ultimate goal of being able to sit back and enjoy the fruits of all your labours. But when that day comes, your anxieties and exertions will have left you with a weak heart, false teeth, prostate trouble, sexual impotence, fuzzy eyesight, and a vile digestion. All this might have been wonderful if, at every stage, you had been able to play it as a game, finding your work as fascinating as poker, chess, or fishing. But for most of us, the day is divided into work time and playtime. The work consisting largely of tasks which others pay us to do because they are abysmally uninteresting. We therefore work, not for the work's sake, but for money. And money is supposed to get us what we really want in our hours of leisure and play. In the United States, even poor people have lots of money compared with the wretched and skinny millions of India, Africa, and China, while our middle and upper classes, or should we say, income groups, are as prosperous as princes. Yet, by and large, they have but slight taste for pleasure. Money alone cannot buy pleasure, though it can help. For enjoyment is an art and a skill for which we have little talent or energy. I live close to a harbour, packed with sailing boats and luxurious cruisers, which are seldom used, because seamanship is a difficult, though rewarding art, which their owners have no time to practice. They bought the boats either as status symbols or as toys, but on discovering that they were not toys, as advertised, they lost interest. The same is true of the entire and astounding abundance of pleasure goods that we can buy. Foodstuffs are prolific, but few know how to cook. Building materials abound in both quantity and variety, yet most homes look as if they had been made by someone who had heard of a house but never seen one. Silks, linens, wools, and cottons are available in colours and patterns galore, and yet most men dress like divinity students or undertakers, while women are slaves to the fashion game with its basic rule, I have conformed sooner than you. The market for artists and sculptors has thrived as never before in history, but the paintings look as if they had been made with excrement or scraps from billboards, and the sculptures like mangled typewriters or charred lumber from a burned-down outhouse. This is not to be taken as a rejection of modern art in general, but only of that rather dominant aspect of it which claims that the artist should represent his time. And since this is the time of junkyards, billboards, and expensive slums, many artists, otherwise bereft of talent, make a name for themselves by the tasteful framing or pedestaling of objets trouvés from the city dump. We have untold stacks of recorded music from every age and culture, and the most superb means of playing it. But who actually listens? Maybe a few pot smokers. This is perhaps a Henry Millerish exaggeration. Nevertheless, it strikes me more and more that America's reputation for materialism is unfounded. That is, if a materialist is a person who thoroughly enjoys the physical world and loves material things. In this sense, we are superb materialists when it comes to the construction of jet aircraft. But when we decorate the inside of these magnificent monsters for the comfort of passengers, it is nothing but frippery. High-heeled, narrow-hipped, doll-type girls, serving imitation warmed-over meals. For our pleasures are not material pleasures, but symbols of pleasure, attractively packaged but inferior in content. The explanation is simple. Most of our products are being made by people who do not enjoy making them, whether as owners or workers. Their aim in the enterprise is not the product, but money, and therefore every trick is used to cut the cost of production and hoodwink the buyer, by colouring and packaging chicanery into the belief that the product is well and truly made. The only exceptions are those products which simply must be excellent for reasons of safety or high cost of purchase, aircraft, computers, space rockets, scientific instruments, and so forth. But the whole scheme is a vicious circle, for when you have made the money, what will you buy with it? Other pretentious fakes made by other money-mad manufacturers. The few real luxuries on the market are imports from backward countries, where peasants and craftsmen still take pride in their work. For example, the state of Oaxaca in Mexico produces some of the finest blankets in the world, and American buyers have been trying to import them in huge quantities. But no amount of money will give the relatively few craftsmen who weave them time to fill the order. If they want the order, they must begin to cheat and produce inferior blankets. The only solution would be to train hundreds of new craftsmen. But Oaxaca is just getting television and has, for some time, had public education, so what up-and-coming young person would want to waste his days weaving blankets? The poets and sages have, indeed, been saying for centuries that success in this world is vanity. The worldly hope men set their hearts upon turns ashes. Or, as we might put it in a more up-to-date idiom, just when our mouth was watering for the ultimate goodies, it turns out to be a mixture of plaster of Paris, papier-mâché, and plastic glue. Comes in any flavour. I have thought of putting this on the market as a universal substance, a prima materia, for making anything and everything, houses, furniture, flowers, bread. They use it already, apples, and even people. The world, they are saying, is a mirage. Everything is forever falling apart, and there's no way of fixing it. And the more strenuously you grasp this airy nothingness, the more swiftly it collapses in your hands. Western technological civilization is, thus far, man's most desperate effort to beat the game, to understand, control, and fix this will-o'-the-wisp called life. And it may be that its very strength and skill will all the more rapidly dissolve its dreams. But if this is not to be so, technical power must be in the hands of a new kind of man. In times past, recognition of the impermanence of the world usually led to withdrawal. On the one hand, ascetics, monks, and hermits tried to exorcise their desires so as to regard the world with benign resignation, or to draw back and back into the depths of consciousness, to become one with the self in its unmanifest state of eternal serenity. On the other hand, others felt that the world was a state of probation, where material goods were to be used in a spirit of stewardship, as loans from the Almighty, and where the main work of life is loving devotion to God and to man. Yet both these responses are based on the initial supposition that the individual is the separate ego, and because this supposition is the work of a double bind, any task undertaken on this basis, including religion, will be self-defeating. Just because it is a hoax from the beginning, the personal ego can make only a phony response to life. For the world is an ever-elusive and ever-disappointing mirage, only from the standpoint of someone standing aside from it, as if it were quite other than himself, and then trying to grasp it. Without birth and death, and without the perpetual transmutation of all the forms of life, the world would be static, rhythmless, undancing, mummified. But a third response is possible. Not withdrawal, not stewardship on the hypothesis of a future reward, but the fullest collaboration with the world as a harmonious system of contained conflicts, based on the realization that the only real I is the whole endless process. This realization is already in us, in the sense that our bodies know it, our bones and nerves and sense organs. We do not know it only in the sense that the thin ray of conscious attention has been taught to ignore it, and taught so thoroughly that we are very genuine fakes indeed. 4. The world is your body. We have now found out that many things which we felt to be basic realities of nature are social fictions, arising from commonly accepted or traditional ways of thinking about the world. These fictions have included 1. The notion that the world is made up or composed of separate bits or things. 2. that things are differing forms of some basic stuff. 3. That individual organisms are such things, and that they are inhabited and partially controlled by independent egos. 4. That the opposite poles of relationships, such as light slash darkness and solid slash space, are in actual conflict, which may result in the permanent victory of one of the poles. 5. That death is evil, and that life must be a constant war against it. 6. That man, individually and collectively, should aspire to be top species and put himself in control of nature. Fictions are useful so long as they are taken as fictions. They are then simply ways of figuring the world, which we agree to follow so that we can act in cooperation, as we agree about inches and hours, numbers and words, mathematical systems and languages. If we have no agreement about measures of time and space, I would have no way of making a date with you at the corner of 42nd Street and 5th Avenue at 3 p.m. on Sunday, April 4th. But the troubles begin when the fictions are taken as facts. Thus, in 1752, the British government instituted a calendar reform which required that September 2nd of that year be dated September 14th, with the result that many people imagined that 11 days had been taken off their lives, and rushed to Westminster screaming, "Give us back our 11 days!" Such confusions of fact and fiction make it all the more difficult to find wider acceptance of common laws, languages, measures, and other useful institutions, and to improve those already employed. But, as we have seen, the deeper troubles arise when we confuse ourselves and our fundamental relationships to the world with fictions, or figures of thought, which are taken for granted, unexamined, and often self-contradictory. Here, as we have also seen, the nub problem is the self-contradictory definition of man himself as a separate and independent being in the world, as distinct from a special action of the world. Part of our difficulty is that the latter view of man seems to make him no more than a puppet, but this is because, in trying to accept or understand the latter view, we are still in the grip of the former. To say that man is an action of the world is not to define him as a thing which is helplessly pushed around by all other things. We have to get beyond Newton's vision of the world as a system of billiard balls in which every individual ball is passively knocked about by all the rest. Remember that Aristotle's and Newton's preoccupation with causal determinism was that they were trying to explain how one thing or event was influenced by others, forgetting that the division of the world into separate things and events was a fiction. To say that certain events are causally connected is only a clumsy way of saying that they are features of the same event, like the head and tail of the cat. It is essential to understand this point thoroughly, that the thing in itself, Kant's Ding an sich, whether animal, vegetable or mineral, is not only unknowable, it does not exist. This is important not only for sanity and peace of mind, but also for the most practical reasons of economics, politics, and technology. Our practical projects have run into confusion again and again through failure to see that individual people, nations, animals, insects, and plants do not exist in or by themselves. This is not to say only that things exist in relation to one another, but that what we call things are no more than glimpses of a unified process. Certainly this process has distinct features which catch our attention, but we must remember that distinction is not separation. Sharp and clear as the crest of the wave may be, it necessarily goes with the smooth and less featured curve of the trough. So also the bright points of the stars go with, if I may now coin a word, the dark background of space. In the Gestalt theory of perception, this is known as the figure-slash-ground relationship. This theory asserts, in brief, that no figure is ever perceived except in relation to a background. If, for example, you come so close to me that the outline of my body lies beyond your field of vision, the thing you will see will no longer be my body. Your attention will instead be captured by a coat button or a necktie. For the theory also asserts that, against any given background, our attention is almost automatically won by any moving shape, in contrast with the stationary background, or by any enclosed or tightly complex feature, in contrast with the simpler, featureless background. Thus, when I draw a simple circle on a blackboard and ask, "What have I drawn?" people will generally identify it as a circle, a ball, a disc, or a ring. Only rarely will someone reply, "A wall with a hole in it." In other words, we do not easily notice that all features of the world hold their boundaries in common with the areas that surround them, that the outline of the figure is also the inline of the background. Let us suppose that my circle/hole figure were to move through a series of four shapes: circle, oval, hourglass, and finally two separate teardrops. Most people would thereupon ascribe the movement, the act, to the enclosed area as if it were an amoeba. But I might just as well have been drawing the dry patches in a thin film of water spread over a polished table. But the point is that in either case, the movement of any feature of the world cannot be ascribed to the outside alone or to the inside alone. Both move together. Our difficulty in noticing both the presence and the action of the background in these simple illustrations is immensely increased when it comes to the behavior of living organisms. When we watch ants scurrying hither and thither over a patch of sand, or people milling around in a public square, it seems absolutely undeniable that the ants and the people are alone responsible for the movement. Yet, in fact, this is only a highly complex version of the simple problem of the three balls moving in space, in which we had to settle for the solution that the entire configuration, Gestalt, is moving. Not the balls alone, not the space alone, not even the balls and the space together in concert, but rather a single field of solid/space of which the balls and the space are, as it were, poles. The illusion that organisms move entirely on their own is immensely persuasive, until we settle down, as scientists do, to describe their behavior carefully. Then the scientist, be he biologist, sociologist, or physicist, finds very rapidly that he cannot say what the organism is doing unless, at the same time, he describes the behavior of its surroundings. Obviously, an organism cannot be described as walking just in terms of leg motion, for the direction and speed of this walking must be described in terms of the ground upon which it moves. Furthermore, this walking is seldom haphazard. It has something to do with food sources in the area, with the hostile or friendly behavior of other organisms, and countless other factors which we do not immediately consider when attention is first drawn to a prowling ant. The more detailed the description of our ant's behavior becomes, the more it has to include such matters as density, humidity, and temperature of the surrounding atmosphere, the types and sources of its food, the social structure of its own species, and that of neighboring species with which it has some symbiotic or preying relationship. When, at last, the whole vast list is compiled and the scientist calls finish for lack of further time or interest, he may well have the impression that the ant's behavior is no more than its automatic and involuntary reaction to its environment. It is attracted by this, repelled by that, kept alive by one condition and destroyed by another. But let us suppose that he turns his attention to some other organism in the ant's neighborhood, perhaps a housewife with a greasy kitchen. He will soon have to include that ant and all its friends and relations as something which determines her behavior. Wherever he turns his attention, he finds, instead of some positive, causal agent, a merely responsive hollow, whose boundaries go this way and that according to outside pressures. Yet, on second thought, this won't do. What does it mean, he asks himself, that a description of what the ant is doing must include what its environment is doing? It means that the thing or entity he is studying and describing has changed. It started out to be the individual ant, but it very quickly became the whole field of activities in which the ant is found. The same thing would happen if one started out to describe a particular organ of the body. It would be utterly unintelligible unless one took into account its relationship.